You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, June 23, 2010, Troy Marshall, Newmarket Battlefield's Director of Interpretation, delivered a PowerPoint presentation entitled Embattled Eden. The presentation detailed the trials and tribulations suffered by the hardworking citizens of the Shenandoah Valley during the Civil War's four horrific years. At least five major military campaigns were fought up and down the valley during the war. Marshall also covered the valley's most famous fighting unit, the five Virginia infantry regiments that made up the hard-fighting Stonewall Brigade. This is the second in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Troy Marshall.
Thank you so much. How's the volume, Dale? Is it good? Okay, good. Getting a thumbs up. My name is Troy Marshall. I'm very honored to speak to you tonight. My main job is doing historical research, but also presenting programs. Most of the time it's to what we call yellow fever. That's when a yellow school bus arrives. So it's very nice to actually use my big words for a change. Now, if I fall into my old pattern of saying, inside voices, all eyes on me, okay, just bear with me. I'm originally from the Cockade City of Petersburg, Virginia, and I have very fond memories of my grandfather taking me around, telling me the history, kind of grandfather to grandson. I do have a grandfather in the 1st Confederate Engineer Regiment that was paroled at Appomattox. I also have an uncle that was in the 18th Illinois at Vicksburg, so I have philosophical flexibility. I can wear blue or gray. So, you know, the Confederates or the Yanks are fine with me. Been in the valley for 9 years, and I've come to love the place because, to me, that place is the exhibit. As I tell folks, if the museum were to go away tomorrow, I could give a tour of the Newmarket Battlefield because it's that space that is so important. And hopefully you'll get a sense when you see the pictures of the space that you can still see today. Now, I've got an image here that's labeled the Shenandoah Valley, and we don't know where it is, but you just, once again, you get the sense of space there in that Harper's Weekly. I promised Rick that this is going to be a little bit under an hour, so there'll be some room for questions, so let's go. That's fine. Is that too dark for you? I have good eyes here, I can see. I chose the title Embattled Eden because really the valley was an Eden. Now, you all know about the breadbasket of the Confederacy, and you know about all the stuff, but think outside the stuff. Think about the people that made their home there. Yes, ma'am, that's perfectly fine. The photo is of an anonymous family leaving the seat of war with their precious belongings, kind of haphazardly thrown in the back. Perhaps they're beginning their refugee trek, we don't really know. But once again, for many residents of the valley, the reality of being dispossessed was a constant threat. For cities like Winchester, where you're going to go, where it changed hands so many times. In fact, it's funny, when you read the accounts, it's like, yay, a certain side was back. And then you have the naysayers, boo, a certain side was back. And it just was that constant, constant threat. As we stop to remember the tragedy of 9/11 9 years ago this year, I recall a visitor coming from Alabama because everything was grounded. And he pulled me aside and he told me that he made a special stop here to connect with the past, as if that past could help him get his mind around what he had just experienced, what we all experienced. And as I struggled, I found out that he was right. You know, our ancestors went through something that was maybe their version of 9/11. It was something traumatic. It was something that caused numbness almost down to the soul. And basically, the point I came away with, if they can make it, just by sheer determination, perhaps I can make it. And so hence, this program was born. Now, I didn't want to do a program that was just from the perspective of politicians or great military iconic leaders or even the common soldier. I wanted to do it from the perspective of the civilians, the people that, in my opinion, have gotten short shrift because they don't carry a rifle. Well, in the Valley, they do sometimes as they maybe shoo off a Union soldier that's, you know, coming along the line there. But it's going to be that experience of maybe what this lady's dealing with here. And this is the Illustrated London News. And notice that it's a woman kind of dragging a child, and you can see a precipice there over a valley. Was that the Shenandoah Valley? Is it an uncertain future for this particular woman here? We don't really know what her experience. But I love this quote, and I've interjected it here because it is a summation of what I've just said. The world's battlefields have been in the heart chiefly. More heroism has been displayed where? In the household and in the closet than on the most memorable battlefields of history. What does ultimately everybody want in the valley? It's the same thing we want, and we'll throw a little Goethe at you. It's early for Goethe, but anyway. Who's happiest? Person that finds peace. Well, during the American Civil War, peace is going to be a high commodity that's bought in a very expensive way. Now, I wanted to look at the reactions to the Civil War from four counties. One would be Frederick County, and I think you're probably going to be going up and seeing that up there in Frederick County. I also wanted to look at Shenandoah County, and that's actually the original 1795 courthouse as well. I wanted to look at it from Rockingham County. It's down in Harrisonburg, and then finally down there in Augusta County. And that's from Bear's album of Virginia, which you can see. Now, I wanted to talk, like I said, just very quickly about things that are going to provide tinder for the box, if you will. Probably have all heard of this quote here. Herman Melville remarked that John Brown's failed attack was the meteor of the war, and the issue of slavery loomed large in the 1850s. Even if you did not have direct activity, you were part of the economy. And I tend to look at it the way the future is going to judge us for being part of our oil economy. You might say, well, I rode a bike every day of my life. Sorry, you're part of that society, that economy. So you're kind of part of it as well. So on October 16th, 1859, John Brown, there he is, looking rather stern, is going to be basically taking a diminutive army of 5 blacks, 13 white men. They enter Harper's Ferry with a wagon load of arms, about 200 rifles, 200 pistols, and 1,000 pikes to arm the flocks of untrained African Americans that are going to come there. Now we have Lieutenant Colonel Lee. Dun, 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 dun. Here he comes. First time my wife saw this picture, she said, "That's not the Robert E. Lee I know." Because, of course, he came out, you know, of the womb with gray hair. Now, we know that he's dispatched with 90 Marines to capture Brown. And there is the famous engine house there. And then we have a huge trial. Think of the O.J. Simpson trial. This is it, okay? This is the big trial of the day. And it basically went from October 26th to November 2nd. And you can see it says the building on the left, far left, is the prison, then the guardhouse, and then the Charlestown courthouse. And here is the very grainy image of the arraignment going on there. Talk of the town. You can imagine that in a day where you don't have a lot of mass media, things are going to not really fire. There's going to be some snapped caps and no burned powder, to use a reenactor idea there. Notice what John Brown said. He thought that it was going to be a mighty conquest, but it's going to be like the last victory of Samson, almost as if he knew that, you know, he wasn't going to make it. This is the Stanton newspaper, The Spectator, October 18th. Notice that it's still listed as a rumored insurrection, as people would come into the courthouse with the idea that something's happened, we can't quite figure it out. Must have been very difficult not to know. Now, of course, Virginia is going to respond very quickly. Execution is going to be scheduled for December 2nd, 1859, and the governor orders the VMI cadets, and here's actually an image of cadets that were sent up from the Institute to get ready for this tremendous upsurge of, of African Americans there to free Brown, which of course doesn't happen. And the Corps is going to be under the command, of Lieutenant Colonel William Gillam, who is going to be kind of the overall commander. The artillery detachment is going to be under this fellow. Who do you think that is? Yes, that's an image done in 1857, attributed to Samuel Pettigrew of Lexington. Doesn't look like the famous Jackson that we're so used to seeing there. But basically, this is the scene as he comes out to go to the gallows there. You've got lots of armed men, and you've got, you know, this wonderful tableau here, as wonderful as it could be under the situation. And then a kind of a lithograph of him going up to the gallows. Here's another image of Jackson, kind of interesting, taken in 1855, and a letter to his wife. Notice it says, Brown was hung today at 11:30 a.m. Now, this is Jackson commenting, you know, the brave warrior, future warrior of the American Civil War, saying he had an unflinching firmness. I think Jackson would have understood what that really meant. You know, he describes in great detail, you know, nothing around his neck beside his shirt collar. Republican Vindicator has an interesting little sidebar. This is but the beginning of the storm. Notice this is October 21st, 1859. This is the beginning of the storm. And what started out no bigger than a man's hand is turning into what? A storm. Okay, everybody is thinking that something big is happening. Nobody knows exactly what's happening. Here's a song sheet, but if you... kind of grainy, but you can see that at the bottom, the famous John Brown song. John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. Okay, once again, he's a martyr, and people who are on that side are going to start using him for all the political sway they can. Here's his grave in North Elba, New York. Torn from the headlines. Once again, Stanton Spectator, this stuff is easily available on the Valley of the Shadow Project. I love this. Old Brown is emphatically the celebrity of the day and will continue to be talked about even after he's gone. He'll continue to be talked about. I love this. Some papers will condemn Brown's conduct. From the northern papers will still seek to mitigate his crime by asserting that he was made crazy by his treatment. So he was misunderstood. Okay? Misunderstood. Now, I would imagine when this is going on, the women get sick of hearing about John Brown and the call of militia and the firing of weapons and the hanging of people. But I would imagine, being a male myself, the young beaux probably are talking nothing but this. Here's the November 1st, 1859 Spectator. Our Stanton Beau is too much a philosopher to waste much time discussing any very grave subject. So the young gentleman in Stanton, anyway, I can't speak for Charlottesville or other places, not too interested. And where are my gentlemen at? Okay, raise your hand so I can see you. Okay, good, all right. This sums it up right here. Why should we puzzle our heads about abstractions? Enough for the day is the evil thereof. If my coat doesn't fit me or my dinner ain't cooked to a turn. Okay, that's enough to distress me without thinking about Harper's Ferry riots. So in typical male fashion, right, we're worried about whether our coat fits or whether we have a hot cooked meal. Let's not worry about that. So people have different ways of dealing with the stressor. The McHugh brothers down in Fincastle are talking about the disturbed state of the public mind. That's a curious statement, isn't it? What does that mean? I think people were talking about nothing but that. The idea that, you know what, we might have a war. So there's probably enthusiasm, but there's also fear. And then it gets even better. Since the excitement, a large company of volunteers. And so you guys are Civil War buffs. You know that after this, once again, the militia movement is going to be a huge spike. Notice what he said. Their intention is to cut off all trade with the North to preserve the Union. So I'm going to cut off trade with those Yanks up there because I want to preserve the Union. But the best quote has to be, I love and cherish the Union. And he says that if this cannot be, I'm ready to shoulder my musket and die in the defense of my country. So you know what? I'm going to save the Union, but I'm going to part company with people that are going to go against my way of life there or threaten So now we have neighbors who might have farmed together, raised barns together. Now they're going to be drilling together. So one of the regiments is the 10th Regiment of Virginia Infantry that's going to be formed during this time. One of the companies, because of this, is the Valley Guards there in Rockingham County. And notice that the events created a military spirit so that you're going to end up with six other companies. So once again, they're like, you know, you get one and then you have more, kind of like Lowe's on every corner or Home Depot. So once again, just some images of plates from these military manuals that Colonel Britton knows intimately there. The Stanton Spectator, here's an image of General John M. Bowdoin before the war in the 1850s. And he's going to be part of a kind of a grassroots community organization that's going to meet to discuss the idea of militia. And so you can see, just a few days after, they're going to be meeting. They're going to be grabbing manuals. And there's going to be a commendation for the young men. They're going to encourage raising others. My personal favorite is the Spirit of Democracy page there, which is the Shenandoah County Newmarket paper. The 10th Legion Artillery, which was a company that didn't really have arms at this point, pre-war militia, they have 45 in the rank and file. Great tie to the Newmarket battlefield because the Bushong House, right there on our battlefield, one of the young sons was in this. Once again, it was a social thing to do, to be part of the militia. Well, now we have to go up after John Brown's hanging with the understanding that there's going to be this reaction from freed slaves and freemen and abolitionists. And so I can imagine, and here's a picture of his mother, Sarah Bushong. This is around Christmas time. This is probably the first Christmas that Frank has been gone from the family. It's kind of a token of war bells, things to come. Frederick County, interesting story here. Continental Morgan Guards. How many people saw Gods and Generals, the movie that Ronald Maxwell did? Well, there's that great scene where they're at First Manassas there, Jackson's Line, and you got the guys wearing the swallowtail coats and the cocked hats. That's the Continental Morgan Guards there. Notice they were formed in 1855. There's an actual picture of one of their swallowtail coats. Looks like what George Washington is going to be wearing. These guys are down in Yorktown celebrating the capitulation of the British when, news reaches them. And what do? They're going to board the fastest conveyance they can to get them up to the valley. And they're going to be under guard for 18 days. So this is going to be the first experience that many of these youngsters have of what's going to be the American Civil War in the valley. Now we get official government administration reacting to it. Okay, the governor's address. How many people read the government addresses, the governor's stuff in the newspaper? Well, they did because they wanted to know that, for example, 550 men are going to be called from Augusta in Rockingham County to go to deal with the potential problem there, including Colonel Smith, who is Superintendent Smith. They called him Old Specs at VMI. In fact, at the VMI Museum, they actually have the chair that he sat in. It was a student's desk that is on display as well. And so he's going to be calling up some cadets, and that's what VMI looked like in 1857. It was just that one big citadel-looking structure. And I'm not going to steal too much of Colonel Gibson's thunder because he's our executive director and will be coming back in August, I believe. There's the howitzer type that they would have used. Notice that I've exhausted the quota of arms. I need blankets and coats. Another example that a war is getting ready to be ginned up and the government is not ready for it. Okay, we build up. What do? We rebuild the enemy, right? And then there's this kind of de-escalation. And then, we have another war. This is just another example. But that's why the militia is there. Now, of course, I'll let Colonel Britton tell you more about the militia later on. 1860, once again, a year of decision. With the sesquicentennial that's coming up, it's almost been, 2010 has almost been kind of a year that people say, there's a sesquicentennial celebration. This is an important turning point because it's going to start to show physically the sectional crisis. The Democratic Party is going to be splitting. And so the politics are always nearby to the weapons, I can promise you that. So here is the election of 1860. Notice that Virginia is going to go for the Constitutional Union Party. How many people have heard of John Bell? Okay, good. Thank you, because nobody has when I usually do this. So you have the Southern Democrats and the Northern Democrats. So you have Virginia supported Bell. The votes tallied in the valley have a very complicated picture, and I always love complicated because it's interesting. Augusta County has a majority for John Bell, and there he is, coming right at you. Rockingham County has a majority for Stephen Douglas. Shenandoah County has a majority for my favorite, I was talking to Rick early, one of my favorite Civil War generals is John Breckinridge, the gifted amateur. Frederick County has a majority for Breckinridge. And what I think you'll find very interesting, I think Shenandoah County was the only one that tallied any votes for Abraham Lincoln, and 13 votes for the Republican ticket was it in these four counties. Fearful times. You know, we talked about the disturbed state of the public mind there. This is Alexander H.H. Stewart, who became the Secretary of the Interior, famous politician, lawyer, and he's writing about a great unquiet and apprehension pervades the public. They talked about it, but it was what they didn't talk about that would have been really interesting to know. And he says, notice that, lest our people be maddened by the occurrences at the South and dragged after the seceding states. I want to keep them out of that vortex. If you read during the Revolution about the colonies of Virginia and others, they're writing about Boston. They're talking about how crazy they were up in Boston. Same kind of idea that if you're in one of those neutral thinking colonies, Stewart is thinking he doesn't want the states to be sent out. And there's an image of him. And he's talking about the upcoming Electoral College, and he says, our political sky is so darkened, I don't have a spirit for it. So once again, another reference to the gloomy sky that's coming out of it. Once again, we all know 1860 is also going to be when secession, December 1860, you see December 20th, South Carolina. But not everybody saw it as a negative. Here's another letter, and notice what it says here. There's nothing talked about except secession. We speak now of the United States as a nation that has what? Passed away as a government that has lived out its allotted time. So they saw it as a positive. I'm sure there were people that were scared as well. 1861, things heat up. You guys know this, so I'm not going to belabor the obvious there. But January 9th, Florida, 10th, Alabama, 11th, Georgia, 19th, Louisiana, 26th, or Louisiana on the 26th, Texas on February 1st. But in February of 61, there was a peace convention that was held in Washington, presided over by ex-President John Tyler. So, of course, you got Davis there and you got Lincoln. And who's stuck in the middle? They brought him out of mothballs, John Tyler. Okay, and the idea was keep them from war if you can. And it's interesting because General Winfield Scott, once again, brought him, you know, probably on a very big horse, members of 14 free states, 7 slave states, and they, on the 27th, 6 constitutional amendments were proposed, but there was a firestorm of bickering. Davis named 3 official commissioners to the Union Capitol, Martin Crawford, John Forsyth, and A.B. Roman. It's not going to work, folks. Once again, we're getting to the point where nobody understands anything. Of course, we have the convention hall there in Richmond there. Interesting statistics. The 13th of 1861 of February, the state convention is assembled in Richmond. They're discussing secession. They have a convention vote, and it's rejected as a motion, 88-45. Now, when they finally vote on it again, it's almost exactly reversed, which I find kind of interesting. The convention sends 3 members to meet with President Lincoln in a last-ditch, 11th-hour effort to quell the crisis. You had William Ballard Preston, George Wythe Randolph, and once again, Alexander H.H. Stewart, probably not feeling any better about it. But unfortunately, by the time that they meet, you know what? Lincoln's call in the wake of Fort Sumter for 75,000 volunteers is what's going to pitch Virginia over the precipice. Up to that point, it's been political. Now you're saying you're going to raise regiments to invade other states. And that's what pushes Virginia over. Where before they were kind of straddling. And so there's Fort Sumter there. There's those regiments raising in the north. And Lincoln is expecting Virginia and people in the valley to man those regiments. It's not going to fly. So hopefully you'll kind of see that it's a slow-burning powder trail. It's not a powder keg like maybe it was in Carolina down there. So once again, we have that convention assembly there. 17th, we actually voted 88-55 in a majority for secession, because once again, that issue has become very close to them. We're dealing with troops to invade other states. And notice that they called for a public vote. So it wasn't just the politicians calling for this, as some may have argued, or maybe some of us that read history today. There's a public referendum as well. The state vote, 132,000 to 37,000. In Augusta County, the vote was 3130 to 10. Now, I want to know, what happened to those 10? They probably went over the mountain to Ohio. Now, it's interesting, when you have a vote, we're not talking about a secret ballot. We're talking about a judge, we're talking about an oath, and we're talking about a public vote that's recorded by a clerk. So it's not like you can just come up there and say, okay, I'm going to vote for this, and then you don't. You're making a public proclamation. Well, there was some terror in the valley. The Southern Claims Commission was created in 71. They had three commissioners, and they're going to deal with loyal Southerners and these claims against the United States government, and you had to prove your loyalty. You had to prove your loyalty. Several claimants from Rockingham County mentioned coercion at the polls. So it hasn't even been a vote yet, and they're already kind of some of the bully boys there from the county. John Gangwerp, for example, described his experience. I never did anything against the Union except vote for secession, which I did through fear. I was opposed to secession. When I went to the polls, I was afraid to vote for the Union or go home without voting. Okay? They were threatened with the halter or hanging and of being shot or run from the country. When I first read this, I had this idea of Jim Crow, where you had the whites terrorizing. Once again, we're talking about, you know, white citizens, free citizens, terrorizing other free citizens. It's kind of an interesting concept. At Mount Crawford Precinct, which is just outside of Harrisonburg, I voted, one man was pursued 3 or 4 miles and brought back. So he was brave enough to say, no, I'm not voting for this, and they went back and brought him back by gunpoint. And maybe an example of some of the bully boys there. Here's an example. This is George Caleb Bingham, and it just shows the voting process. There are people around listening to how you vote. A little bit scandalous and dangerous. Another guy, Joel Garber, remembered his experience at Mount Crawford. He was going to vote the Union ticket. The men came to my house and told me that I would be hung. So this is before the vote. They had probably a list, okay, of the miscreants, and they're going down their list. Okay, it's like cold calls. All right, you take this side of the county, you know, bring a big gun. There was a perfect reign of terror. And Union men were everywhere threatened. This is the commissioner saying, we have abundant evidence of terrorism at that place. This is 1871, and they're talking about terrorism, because that's what it was. These guys knew that if they didn't go or vote the party line, there was going to be a problem. Once again, downtown Richmond there, a lovely statue there of Washington. You know, Virginia is going to start building her army. The government wasted little time. This is the famous order number 63 that's going to dispatch Jackson to come to Camp Lee for camp of instruction. And that kind of great image of Kunstler there, of Jackson taking the cadets away. Everybody's cheering. Great quote. And I wish I could remember the soldier who was in his 30s. He wrote later on home, he said, oh, how I hate that little cadet. This guy's about 15 or 16, and he's making this 30-year-old jump and go through drill evolutions and probably had him a riding crop and made him toe the line. So, once again, youngsters, but that's what Virginia needed. Nice nighttime image of Harper's Ferry there. Governor Letcher is going to send Jackson, commanding Virginia troops at Harper's Ferry. And these valley men are going to be organized into these famous Virginia Ute regiments that everybody's read about. In fact, folks I was talking to that have valley heritage, you might have some relatives in these particular units here. There's Honest John Letcher. He looks honest, doesn't he? Jackson's promoted to Brigadier General in July of 61. And we actually have at the VMI Museum his professor's uniform that has Brigadier General's shoulder straps that he was wearing there at First Bull Run or First Manassas. We've also got the taxidermied hide of Little Sorrel. It was a sorrel gelding that was known as Little Sorrel, captured from a train in Harper's Ferry. It was a favorite with Jackson. Originally given the name of Fancy, but described as a small mount with about 15 hands, had a very strong endurance. This horse lived almost like royalty at VMI after Jackson's death, and literally was on the ground just a couple days, and they decided they wanted to taxidermy the hide. And we have literally this horse hide preserved that Jackson's saddle, which you see there, was put right on top. It was recently cleaned. When I first saw it, it was kind of dirty. Give you an idea that the velvet, they weren't sure that the velvet was still there, but it was so dirty when they brought the conservators in and they cleaned that, the velvet is still there. That's how dirty it was. So the next time you're at the VMI Museum, you want to see a Little Sorrel. I know it's an interesting artifact. Militia levies. Once again, with the governor's proclamation, with building an army, comes these militia levies. This is a newspaper article, and it's talking about Siebert's company of Irishmen. They're working on the Manassas Gap Railroad that had reached as far as Mount Jackson. These are Irish rail workers, and literally, here comes the patriotic zeal. These guys lay down their picks and shovels and form up. So if you saw that scene out of Ronald Maxwell's film, Gods and Generals, there's some of Jackson's troop with a Harp of Aaron flag. That's the Emerald Guard, which is going to be this particular group here. May of 61 in that article there. And of course, the Shamrock, of course. A good citizen. What does it mean to be a good citizen? We teach our kids ethics, character. There are character institutes all over the place. What does it mean to be a good citizen? Well, not everybody was anxious to go to war. Jacob Lindsay described his experience at a militia gathering. They came and got him, took him to Port Republic. Here's how he responded in his deposition. When he asked if he had taken the oath of allegiance, here's what he said. They were called up. We went in line, commanded to hold a hand up and take the oath, but wait. He said, I stepped back and did not hold my right hand up. It's amazing nobody noticed that. Okay, it's open defiance. The prosecutor said, why did you go? And he says, if I hadn't, they would have arrested me. People can't sit down in rebellious states and do as they please. Here's an idea, a nice newspaper article there, the voluntary manner into which some Southern volunteers enlist. And I'll step down so you can see. You've got a guy with bayonets pushing him through the door and implements of torture there behind the officer. I'm sure Colonel Brenton was a good officer. He didn't employ any of these. Notice that his claim was disallowed. He wasn't loyal enough because he went. I think he got robbed. Raise your hand if you think he got robbed. Oh, okay, thank you. Okay. What are your choices if you're a Union man? Well, you can avoid military service, flee over the mountains. They had something called the Home Guard. They could find you. And you don't want to be considered, kind of on the run there. You could face harassment and prison for abetting these people. You could, hire a substitute. How many people would maybe consider that option there? Was that something that a lot of sides, people on each side did? Sure. I mean, it was, if you could afford it. If you were a member of a peace religion, you could take a substitute out of the ranks when you could afford to pay the commutation fine of $500. There were two conscription acts. One is April 16th. of 62, which made no provision for conscientious objection. But then they kind of altered it with an act of October 62, which exempted Quakers, Nazarenes, Mennonites, and Dunkers. You got a lot of Anabaptists and other religious trends up in the valley. And so for $500, you could exempt somebody out of the ranks. Now, I can tell you, now we're getting into major league action. Once again, it's been kind of junior league so far. Now we're getting into the tremendous battle that is going to be heard all the way from Manassas in the valley. And of course, July 21st, I'm not going to throw all the details, but you've got green troops. Here's Irvin McDowell leading green troops. You've got Beauregard, and you've got Johnson there, who are going to use things like railroads for the first time to move troops. It's a confused battle, but it's going to be kind of a taste of things to come. It's also going to make a reputation of a brigade and a man. And those troops that got their start in their organization in the valley, they're going to be watching him and watching that brigade. It's interesting. People are now writing. They've been writing before, but now that battle and folks are out in the field, they're going to be writing. John Whalen, famous valley historian, is going to be writing. His mother writes, and I love her stuff because she must have been so busy. I think they had three or four kids. Notice her entry. Battle fought at Bull's Run. Okay, I've got to go wash the clothes now. Mr. Waddell, Joseph Waddell from Stanton, his diary still exists. He remembers the Telegraph reports a fight in Manassas Junction. Victory is attributed to our side. He's going to also be writing, total loss 10 to 12,000, most of the volunteers on the field. Can you imagine getting a rumor that 12,000 people have been killed? Must have been unbelievable. Booty captured after the battlefield of Manassas there is said to be immense. Federalists seem to have anticipated an easy march and provided all sorts of luxury. So as soon as the soldiers leave, then there's capitalism, right? Here's some actual graves there on that field there at First Manassas. Once again, Winchester is going to be, you're all heading up that way. There were factions there. You had the pro-unionist ladies, and they're the ones that are keeping a lot of diaries, and the pro-southern ladies. And literally, it's like a tennis match. When one side would come in and chase the other out, there was exuberance or there was fear. Julia Chase, news this afternoon that Beauregard had driven the forces back, but we place little dependence on anything we hear. That must have been so annoying not to have heard. As a state employee, when the Virginia Tech shooting took place, literally, we had instant notification that something had happened. Couldn't tell you what it was, but my beeper was going crazy, and we knew something was going on. Can you imagine just these rumors that would roll in? She writes, 3 days later, sadness seems to pervade every countenance. It's horrible to think. Once again, Jackson comes into Winchester there. You'll be on these streets. There's a good shot of the street there. It's also a good shot of the Taylor Hotel, which is going to be used as a hospital, and Jackson's headquarters there. Of course, a good shot of Jackson. So again, just going to roll through these. Julia Chase, okay, the town is astir. The citizens feel completely safe now. Example of some of those soldiers, the different uniforms there. So there's going to be this change of power, but then we have 62, and Jackson's fortunes and troops in the valley. How many people have heard of Romney? Well, Romney for Jackson is going to be something that's going to give him fits and starts, and came this close to losing a Stonewall Jackson. And here's why. There he is. He decides that he's going to take a nice little stroll. He's going to take General William Loring's men. And there he is right there. And he's going to march them towards Romney to drive a wedge between the Federals and the Alleghenies. And so January 1st, his men have forced about 7,500 volunteers, over 2,000 militia, about 650 cavalry. They head up towards Romney. On the way, General Loring exploded, "By God, sir, this is the damnedest outrage ever perpetrated in the annals of history, keeping my men out here without in the cold without food." And then Jackson placed Loring's men at Romney, and he turns his folks and he heads them back to Winchester. January 25th, 11 officers from Loring's brigade sign a petition calling his competency as a leader into question. Secretary of War Benjamin orders Jackson to relocate Loring's men, and he wrote the secretary, "With such interference, I can't expect to be much service, and accordingly respectfully request to be ordered to report to duty to the superintendent at VMI." Going back to VMI, folks. Okay? And literally it's going to be John Letcher and the Secretary of War with Alexander Boteler who come together and say, "Jackson, withdraw your resignation." And he finally does. And so, once again, not a great start for the new year. But I think it provides maybe a clean slate for Jackson. Okay, if you saw the PBS series, the Kinsburn, you've seen this map. Once again, 1862, the valley is going to be on fire with battles. I'm just kind of going to roll through these. Notice what Joseph Wildell says. Militia from this county had to report. They've called out 40,000 men. That's got to be a rumor. 40,000 men. This particular man here is Jacob Hildebrand. He's a Mennonite, and he finally says, "I'm going to report for militia service." Now, he said, "I don't know if I'll ever come back again." So there were a lot of Mennonites that did not take to making oaths, but some finally succumbed and did. Nathaniel P. Banks there in his troops. So once again, we have a change of base. And what does Mrs. Whalen say? "Yankees took Winchester." Now, historians, we don't like to read those kind of things. We like the meat on the bones. "Mr. Waddell, intelligence came last night. Jackson is having withdrawn his army. So from his point of view, not a good thing." Julia Chase reveled in the news. "The Union Army is here again." Well, Laura Lee is a strong supporter of the South. And she said, "After a wretched night, the enemy marched in, swarming on every street with flags flying and bands playing Yankee Doodle." Cornelia Peake McDonald, her husband was a cavalry officer, and notice what this says. He was saying that she heard music at a distance, and then literally her boys got up and said, "Bring her back." And it's, no, that's the wrong tune. It's the wrong tune. "Run, hide the silver." You know. Kate Sperry is my favorite. "I take it every way. I mean, the Yanks being here. Sometimes I'm philosophic, and I endure it in silence and contempt. The next minute, I'm ready to cuss the whole herd and piously wish them in Hades." Okay, so once again, that town is going to be turned over and turned over and turned over. Kernstown, once again, it's going to be a tactical defeat for Jackson. You can see that stone wall. In fact, when you go to Winchester, the Battle of Kernstown, you have the KBA site, but if you go to where Glen Burnie is in the Museum of the Shenandoah Valley, they have a house called Rose Hill. They have a section of that wall that's actually been rebuilt. It's fabulous, this wall that you're seeing right over here. This is going to be one of the first bloodlettings that these people are going to have, that it's right in front of them. Look at this. They're saying, you know, notice what she says. Nerve yourselves to hear the worst. Nerve yourselves to hear the worst. Calm before the storm. Enemies coming nearer and nearer. Can you feel the apprehension? Nearer and nearer and nearer. How are we going to make it? How do you protect your family? I love this. "The secesh ladies have all adopted sunbonnets with long curtains called Jeff Davis bonnets. They put on many airs and frowns and sneers, and they try in every way to put down the Union people." So can you kind of see it? They're walking down one side of the street, and here comes the other side, and they just kind of sneer. They pull those Jeff Davis bonnets. You know, these are, once again, these are, quote-unquote, neighbors that are dealing with all this. Jacob Hildebrand again. His son left to go down the valley to drive out Abe Lincoln's hiring tools who were invading our soil. I love that quote. Abe Lincoln's hiring tools. Of course, you've got, you know, McDowell on May 8th. You've also got Front Royal and these other battles there in the Valley Campaign right around these people. That's going to be the problem, because when you get closer and closer, McDowell is over here. Front Royal is to the north of our four counties. But guess what? Here we go again. Yesterday morning, Jackson had routed the enemy, and it's not that they're gone that's his most important, but it's they've gone to Winchester to buy goods, okay? What kind of stuff might you buy there? Well, maybe a sewing machine, Ward's perfect-fitting shirts, camp mess kettles, metallic collars, you know, this kind of stuff. Jacob Hildebrand, once again, is saying, yeah, a large quantity of stores. Must have been important in 62. Julia Chase, it's an awful day. The citizens in town have become demons almost. I can imagine in the war furor that some of these citizens, when they see the Union forces heading out, maybe they grab a weapon. So like I said, it's not like Quantrill's folks out there or Bloody Bill Anderson, but I can imagine that if you see those Yanks who maybe have been terrorizing you, you might want to take a weapon and chase them off, or a broom if you're one of the ladies. Here's the Bushong house. Sarah Bushong again, and we have a letter from the son who had served in the 10th Legion Artillery. He is in Comanche, Iowa. He had done all the service he wanted to see, and he went out to Iowa to farm. When he was there, four of the folks with Brown were hung. He witnessed that, so he's going to be out. He wants to know if his brother's been in any battles. He's been in the militia, Anderson has. And so notice he says, I want news the worst kind. He wants to know what's going on there. Here's a good picture of Confederates, you know, in kind of a corral in May of 1862. So you get a kind of an idea, and it's a snapshot after all this. So what's coming up? Well, somebody tell me who that is at the top. Fremont, yes, and at the bottom, James Shields. Well, they got a little trap for Jackson. And so we've got Ewell, who is going to be working with Jackson, cooperating, and is going to be laying a trap for these fellows. And so Ewell is going to delay Fremont so that Jackson could defeat Shields. And he accomplishes this mission at the Battle of Cross Keys on June 8th. And there we go right there. And so once that force is going to be taken care of, and basically Jackson is going to basically take care of Shields there at the Battle of Port Republic. We actually have an interesting artifact in our collection. I didn't know we had this. There were two armor manufacturers during the Civil War. This one is six pieces of metal strips that one of the men of the 7th Indiana, I think, because it was picked off of his body by an artillery officer. So this poor fellow's marching in that June heat with what looks like a breast and back from a soldier at Jamestown here at the Battle of Port Republic. Somebody sold it to him, weighs 25 pounds. When I tell the kids that they had armor back then, they like that. So hot, balmy, and those troops are going to march right into that force. Jacob Hildebrand again. Jackson engaged Shields below Port Republic, and he drove him from the field with considerable loss. So once this happens now, this pincer movement that's supposed to kind of corral Jackson is gone. Monday night, a courier arrives with intelligence that Jackson had been ordered to retreat across the Blue Ridge. The news flew through town and caused a depression. Once again, their savior, their fort protector, has now been ordered to leave. It's impossible to describe. Notice what he says. We hear that Jackson's whole command is to move. He's been in town all day, but found out that no one could find out what he was doing, where he was going. I'm sure people should probably ask him. Going to put the troops on the cars, and where do they go? Well, you see that kind of purple line? That's the Virginia Central Railroad. They're going to take it all the way back to Richmond, the valley, pretty much left open, nobody there to bug them. And, of course, you've got Johnson, who is going to be wounded and is going to remark that that wounding was the best thing that the South had happen to him, because Lee is going to be taking over and renaming and reorganizing the Army of Northern Virginia, an early indication of where he expected to serve. And you know what? He didn't really have a great career. Somebody tell me some of the nicknames that Lee had early in the war. Granny. What else? King of Spades. What else? Evacuating Lee. Okay, once again, he didn't do that great in the mountain passes against McClellan, but guess what? He's about to get a rematch. You know, one of those like celebrity death matches there. So we're going to be having a number of battles known as the 7 days. And like I said, I'm not gonna bore you with all the details, but let's catch up to Malvern Hill. Here's what I find very interesting. Get through, we have our commanders here. June 24th, the news we've had from the east for about a week has been bought by only by folks on horseback. So the rail line is down. So they're cut off. July 2nd, day after Malvern Hill, a very heavy, rapid cannonading. They heard the Battle of Malvern Hill from the valley. They could hear that. They could also hear when the news finally arrived. Yesterday, a poor woman who lives in town heard that her husband had been killed. The wailings were kept up for an hour or two. So, once again, once the news arrives, those casualty lists must have been horrific. Now, of course, as we get into later on after this, the next battle, Groveton, 2nd Manassas there, Jackson pulls back to Groveton, and let's see, Groveton is right here. For those right behind me, I'll just kind of circle it so you can see it. And he's there to await Lee, but couldn't resist the opportunity to strike the Iron Brigade as it came into view. Fighting along an unfinished railroad cut at the edge of the old Manassas battlefield, he barely held out until the arrival of Lee and the rest of the ANV is going to allow the Confederates to win the Second Battle of Manassas, 29 and 30 of August. Pope is going to retreat in disarray and was soon sent west to fight those Indians. Of course, just some scenes of the battle there. And, of course, Confederates using anything they can to pop open that canned lobster and other stuff there, and the railroad cut there. And, of course, just the kind of worn-out nature of Pope's army as it falls back. Julia Chase, the whole town is alarmed because, once again, as these forces start to pull back, they're going to be exploding, burning things. So the whole town is going to be alarmed by the magazine at the fort. September 2nd, saw a bright light coming down at the depot. It's Laura Lee. Found the depot building and the warehouses were on fire. Instantly saw a huge explosion. So imagine a magazine going off in the middle of the night. You're going to see kind of flashes and you're going to hear this thud. Cornelia Peake McDonald said literally the whole house was shaken to its foundation. The glass blows out the windows. They think they're under fire. They don't know what's going on. Once again, just another, they're in bed, waking up with glass on them. So, once again, Manassas is over. The valley's clear. What does Lee do? Where's my Civil War buffs? What do they do? We've got to go and try to get a kind of a death punch, right? We've got to get that slam dunk, that touchdown, that Everest. We need a classic, real good victory, right? And so Lee is going to be taking his folks up into Maryland there, culminating in the Battle of Antietam. Like I said, I'm not going to bore you with all the details because you guys know this. But here's the bad news, okay? Bad news is going to be carnage, empty chairs, lots of letters. Laura Lee said the reports tonight from the fighting a day later are terrible. It's said to be the bloodiest battle of the war. You know, when I grew up studying the Civil War, I always heard, Antietam was the bloodiest, single bloodiest battle. This particular person is almost prophetic. Our loss is reported to be 20,000, but this must be an exaggeration. And of course, one debacle for the North leads to another one. Who is this particular gentleman here? Burnside, yes. And of course, what famous battle is going to earn him, I think, the title of the worst general in American history, right? Fredericksburg. Not to be outdone by the Mud March there, which is going to end up having him removed to a lesser command, although when you get to my hometown of Petersburg, he's commanding the Ninth Corps there. So, 1863, and the battle that we all think about in 63 that really impact folks in Virginia and in the Valley is what battle? Chancellorsville, right? That gambler's instinct, that subordinate that is going to be able to follow through using good intelligence, local guides, But it also means that, and this is actually the raincoat we have on display at the VMI Museum. You can see the bullet hole in that. So it means that He's mortally wounded on Saturday, May 2nd. That means that that southern icon, there you see him there, there's going to be a lot of ladies that are mourning that, and soldiers, and Robert E. Lee. May 10th, he's going to die in a small bungalow near Guinea Station, below Fredericksburg. Pneumonia ravages his body. His body's moved to Lexington via packet boat and arrives on May 14th. Now, for the Battle of New Market, May 15th, many of those cadets are going to be there at the cemetery as his burial escort, which is interesting. They're going to be firing. You see, of course, that great quote, there's a wail of woe. That famous battery that he commanded at VMI, they were painted red to show that they were state property. And they're like two-thirds scale. Jackson used those weapons there at VMI, and he taught artillery tactics with those particular pieces, and they're still on display. Of course, you know, Lee didn't get the victory he needed, so he needs once again to pull ahead. We've got to have that. That's going to bring in the politics. It's going to link the politicians. It's going to bring economy. So you're going to have the economist. You're going to have the capitalist. You're going to have foreign intervention as well. So all that stuff is going to link together with, once again, the slam dunk. And so by moving north, ending up at a very horrible place that you guys know as Gettysburg. Terrible place. And as those soldiers march away from the valley, on the way, guess what? There's another Battle of Winchester. The Battle of Second Winchester was fought June 13 through 1563. Richard Ewell has about 12,500 men, and he's going to defeat that guy that's in the valley all the time, it seems like, Brigadier General Robert Milroy, who had about 7,200 men. But once again, when you go to Winchester, it's hard to figure out where you're at because you got 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Winchester. So there's the occupation and there's battles aplenty up there. And so notice, you know, Julia Chase, wow, exciting times. Joseph Waddell, wow, Ewell has captured a large number of Yankees. There's a large quantity of ordnance and other stores. So once again, he must have been a capitalist there. He liked getting that stuff. So once again, that horrible battle. And these kind of iconic pictures there. And then you end up with a scene from Gaines Mill, but imagine this scene. You have Jacob Hildebrand, who's going down to Port Republic, and he says that the Yankees buried their dead. Many of the graves, the hogs, rooted the bodies out. So not only do you have the battles, but you have graves, bones, scattered equipment, busted stuff, and then hogs are rooting the bodies out from Port Republic a year earlier. Okay, so that must not have been pretty. 64, once again, new man on the block. Instead of being a normal general and riding herd on the armies from D.C., Grant says, no, I don't want to be distracted by you guys up there. Against the wishes of the Secretary of War, by the way, he decides that he's going to ride herd over the Army of the Potomac, leaving Meade in command, but then he's going to have other folks, trusted subordinates, and then some that he doesn't trust too well. You have Sherman to take over in the west. You've got Butler, who's going to move up against Richmond from the south. You have Banks again, once again, Red River. And you have Franz Siegel, the man who basically sacks himself a couple of times and then finds the nearest Midwest congressman and gets a new command. He's going to be the commander that's going to be operating through the valley. And of course, with this new spring offensive there, no longer is Richmond our idea. Let's go on to Richmond. No. It's find the Confederate Army wherever it is and pitch into it, destroy it. I mean, to the man. Because once again, if you do that, then Lee can't use his interior lines and bring troops from everywhere because we're going to have every commander kick off now. And they kick off. That was the idea. That's Grant's bullheaded genius there. One of the things, we've lost Jackson. Now we're going to lose Stuart, who is going to be killed, shot in the saddle there at Yellow Tavern. Which is going to be kind of rough. So, you know, on May 11th there, one of Philip Sheridan's troopers is going to shoot him when he was on horseback. Back to the Valley. We have Franz Siegel here. You have John C. Breckinridge. They sound like they're having a better party over in that room next to us over there. I don't know if I can compete with that, Rick. So you have these relative newcomers to the Valley. You've all heard of Breckinridge. This guy had political savvy. It was said when he talked, he had a silver tongue. Franz Siegel showed up and is going to be an educator. He's part of the revolutionary armies in Europe. Doesn't do that well, but there's no Carfax for generals, so you can't check him out. He does bring the Dutch vote, as they said. He brings the German vote. And so at the Battle of Newmarket, these two opponents are going to meet. Now, Siegel makes the classic bumbling boo-boo. Don't stretch your line out. Breckinridge shows up with everybody he has because Siegel has about 9,000 men. Breckinridge has about 5,500. So he can't afford to show up piecemeal. Battle of Newmarket has VMI cadets. The youngest cadet was 15 for 20 days. Average age is 16. And so here's a Keith Rocco image of the cadets there. One of the locals was a milliner, and she worked in Newmarket, and somebody told her there was a battle nearby, and she stood on her doorstep, and she saw the cadets coming down the hill in perfect precision. The white flag made her think the French army had arrived, and so she said, "The French have arrived!" Then she said she saw a huge explosion, and cadets were down, and they closed up so beautifully. She said for the rest of her life, she never forgot that. Here's an example of some of those cadets that were at Newmarket. Shelter from the storm. You know, we talked about the Bushongs, going to militia service, going out west. Three generations are going to be in the house. There's no written account, but we do have an oral history. Bushong family does survive, and their home is going to be turned into a hospital. So imagine, if you could look through the fence, you're going to see soldiers everywhere. Doors are taken off, sawhorses, barrels, anything they can use to bring these guys in. This image is about 1880. It's the earliest image that we have. Now, it's hard to see, but right here is the basement entrance. So all the family could see were a bunch of legs running by the door if they were brave enough to peer out of a window. I wouldn't. This is Savage's station. That's probably what the backyard looked like. It's kind of hard to see, but it's just wounded men everywhere. So that's going to be called Battlefield House. Cadets are going to be from all over, mostly Virginia. Here's one from North Carolina, and his father wrote a letter 15 days after the battle. His name was William Hugh McDowell, and he said, "Your letter informing me the death of my son has been received. It came upon me like a clap of thunder in a clear sky. I wasn't even aware the cadets had been called out." Once again, information. Information is so important to these guys. Now, new commander. That's going to be David Hunter. Siegel gets sacked. Well, he doesn't get sacked. He gets the reserve division, which is where they send the people that don't have a command too much. And David Hunter is going to be heading to Lynchburg, and he makes a side trip to VMI. There are cannon there, there are guns there, there are swords, and probably a little payback. Okay, it's an installation. And so who's there? Well, you have Superintendent Francis Smith, the guy that was sitting in the little student's chair earlier, there he is as a major general. Who's in the middle? Captain Henry DuPont. This guy wanted to go to VMI, but they told him, "Sorry, buddy, you're from Delaware. You have to be a Virginian to go to VMI." And so he went to that other school on the Hudson. You might have heard of it called West Point. So at Newmarket, he was commanding a regular Army battery, Battery B, 5th United States Artillery. I've wondered, what would happen if he went to VMI? Be commanding probably a Confederate battery, possibly. And so you can see an image kind of right here of VMI being burned from the crest, or after it's being burned, obviously, from the crest of the hill. Here he is as a senator with his Medal of Honor that he got, I think, for Cedar Creek. Yeah, I think it was Cedar Creek. And he worked with a Newmarket cadet named Thomas Staples Martin, and they raised $214,723 to rebuild VMI. So when you go to VMI today, the Jackson Memorial Hall is what they built, because VMI had been rebuilt by that point. So you have a former Union officer and you have a former Newmarket cadet working together to rebuild. Kind of interesting story. Now, once again, moving quite along, we still haven't gotten that hammer punch up north there. We need to take direction and focus away from Virginia, especially the valley. So who is this gentleman? That's right. That's General Early. And what's he going to do? Well, he's going to be moving on up and eventually will take on Washington. And you can imagine that as he makes it up, Battle of Monocacy slows him down. And literally, Washington, they're offloading the Sixth Corps guys at, I think it was the 6th Street Public Docks, I think it was. And they rush those guys to get them in line. Could have been a disaster. Recognize the ruins here? We talk about total war in the valley or in Virginia. We forget about total war in the north. It's actually the ruins of Chambersburg. Here's another image of that. And another kind of just an image of burned out ruins there. August 9th, one or two persons, General McCausland, arrived in town, said they had, by order of Early, a demand for $100,000. It was also, you could, $100,000 gold or another paper denomination. And they kept dragging their feet, and so it was burned. Notice what it says. Our men say the affair was extremely painful to them. I don't think anybody wanted to do it too much. Some probably did. But once again, taking that fight to the civilians. Well, fall of 1864, people in the valley have something they call the burning. And it's basically when Sheridan comes to the valley, and the idea is to clean this place out. I have talked to people who literally say, I remember my great-grandmother telling me that when she was a child, she heard from her ear her grandmother talking about the burning. Folks rolled in, took stock. It's a living memory for these people in the valley. Notice what the orders from Grant to Sheridan. Nothing should be left to invite the enemy. It's desirable that buildings should... It's not desirable that buildings should be destroyed. Rather, they should be protected. That did happen, and sometimes it did not happen. And so what you end up with is just this rain of destruction going up. And of course, you recognize Custer. There's General Devin's men burning gristmills on North Fork. Here's from the J.E. Taylor sketchbook. There's just nothing but this burning piles of smoke there. And it's just what it must have looked like. One young boy said he sat on top of the mountain and you could just see nothing but fires as far as the eye could see. Here we go, our famous Jacob Hildebrand here. What does he say? Yankees are burning every barn they come across that either has hay or grain in it. So if it was an empty barn, ideally they shouldn't burn it, right? Because that's just being mean. Here's an interesting twist on it. It says, the Richmond Dispatch says that the New York Herald published a letter from Grant ordering him to burn every house, destroy every mill, kill every horse, sheep, cow. That doesn't sound like the orders that are published in Grant's memoirs, does it? I think maybe the message is wrong. All they could hear was burn everything, destroy, sack, you know, like the Vikings are coming to the valley. Battle of Third Winchester. It's a decisive battle. September 19th, 1864. Early's got about 15,000 men. Sheridan's got about 39,000. And a local spy allows him to maneuver through the Berryville Canyon, and once again, it's going to be a rout through the streets of Winchester. There's cavalry units break through the Confederate left. Notice what Waddell said. A deep feeling of gloom pervades the community. Life has no charms anymore. We're sick of war. It's in our face, and we want it over. Julia Chase, considerable of a stampede occurred before the army retreated. A great commotion of amps. So imagine it's just like people, ambulances, horses, mules, civilians, people running amok in every direction. This is George S. Patton Sr., who is Georgie Patton, George S. Patton Jr. of World War II fame, his grandfather there, who is going to be mortally wounded at the battle. And here's little Georgie as a cadet. He went to VMI. Good to remember this early on. Went 1 year, 1903, 1904. That's right. He would have been class of 1907. The family has, and here he is in his World War II fame, the family had a box that had a piece of a shirt and a shell fragment. And apparently Mrs. Patton, Grandmother Patton, would pull it out and show it to Georgie and talk about the family lineage because he had relatives in the cadet corps. He had an uncle that was there at Newmarket. He had a grandfather who was at Newmarket. And she would pull that shell fragment out and show him in the shirt where he was hit. We have that box. It's at the VMI Museum. And you can see the ticking shirt, and you can see that shell fragment, and it's sharp as a razor. And so, mortally wounded at the Battle of Third Winchester. It's, like I said, confusing to get up there. Well, guess what? It's a different game. Battle of Fisher's Hill in September of 64. Sheridan is not taking any prisoners. He's not holding any punches. Battle of Cedar Creek, when he was away, started out as a Confederate victory, but as you know, his famous ride is going to rally those troops. And it's going to mean, you know, a good Union victory. So that Newmarket is really the last Confederate victory that you can, oh yeah, it's a Confederate victory. It's not the fortunes of war that are going to change it. Now, very quickly, a new election. Southerners, I think, are deciding fortunes of war with the weapon are failing. Maybe fortunes with the vote will help us. And so that election of 1864, there we go. No, I don't want to connect to the internet. Thank you. There's a good election of the soldier vote. Isn't technology wonderful? And the winner is Abraham Lincoln. Thank you. Okay. So, you know, that we can't win militarily. Maybe we win politically. No, that doesn't work. 65. What's going to happen? Well, of course, you know, Petersburg. There's going to be just, it just goes on and on and on. I think people thought it would go on for 100 years. Finally, the back is broken at Petersburg. And there's, of course, the courthouse there at Petersburg. Union troops come in. Richmond is evacuated. Some of it's burned. I think that's maybe the Haxel Mill there. I'm not sure. Lincoln comes in, sets in Davis's chair there at the mansion there on Clay Street, which is now the White House of the Confederacy. And, of course, the famous place that Ron will recognize, I'm sure. Appomattox there. What does this mean? Well, of course, you made it that far. Like my ancestor, you had a parole. You could go home unmolested. As I recall, you could ride on government conveyance trains. You got rations. If you were at Sailor's Creek and captured, they probably were you were on your way someplace else. Not too happy for you. So what does this mean? It means if you're a Southerner, you're going to arrive back home, and if your house is intact, you're probably the exception to the neighborhood rule. There's going to be, like I said, graves everywhere. If you're a Union soldier, you're going back. This is a piece of work called A Soldier in a New Field, and it's a Union volunteer coming home to abundance, coming home to growth. You know, I've been gone for 4 years. Oh, look at all the changes. Look to that Confederate soldier. That's going to be houses in the valley, just like that. Jacob Hildebrand, he goes to Dinwiddie County, about 15 minutes from where I grew up, and he found out that his son died and was buried without a coffin. So he took him up, and he made one and interred him. And then he comes back, and he gets him the next month, and he buries him in Augusta County. Notice what he said, "Oh, my son, how I miss you. I have a 4.5-year-old son. I just couldn't imagine having to deal with that. April 23rd, Bush Homes. They're basically going to be told that their father's barn was not burned. Though as to what we wear, we patch up the old clothes and make ourselves believe we look right. So I don't think they're pulling curtains down off the wall like Scarlett O'Hara, but it's not going to be really, you know, glorified stuff. Here's the barn in 1899. The barn was struck by lightning in 1936 and burned to the ground. So Sheridan couldn't destroy it, but a bolt of lightning did. And of course, images of the family there, and those lovely Parisian fashions from 1865 that nobody looks like. Well, once again, we're still picking up the pieces to this day. This is 65 at Cold Harbor. They're going out, they're reburying those bodies in those national cemeteries that we see around. May of 1865, you have four Confederates, and they're wired at this point to be soldiers. They're going to Woodstock to get paroles, and they come up on some guys in the 22nd New York Cavalry, pull pistols on them, and steal their horses. Oops. They go home, and some of the fathers are shocked, to say the least. They come back outside of Newmarket. They meet with Colonel Butterfield. They return the horses. All is forgiven. Well, the 22nd New York Cavalry shows up, and these guys are arrested. Summers and Kuntz. Colonel Butterfield goes on furlough, doesn't leave any record of a good faith return. So his subordinate can't clear these guys. So on June 27th at 7:30 p.m., Summers and Kuntz are executed by firing squad. So just north of Newmarket is an obelisk, and there's a sign that says post-Appomattox tragedy. This is an article written 2 weeks after the execution from one of the fathers. They informed me that they had come to arrest my son, and I stated, if it's on account of those horses, I've already turned them back in. Little did I think this would be the party that would send a fatal dart and cause the lifeblood to flow as free as water. And the epitaph, here they met a body of infantry who informed them they would be executed on the spot. They were shot to death, no mercy, no trial, no prayer. That's pretty hardcore, folks. And there's the marker that the Shenandoah Valley Battlefields Foundation has opened up so you can go up to it. Post-Appomattox tragedy. So, folks come back together. They plant. Thank you so much. They plant. They remember. And they start to do what young men do. One of the Bushongs gets a letter that said, Frank, you got to come home. He's out in Iowa. There's too many girls now for the boys. I hope to get married soon. And here it is. Frank, you must come home soon. There are too many girls. I have an idea of getting married. Henry Spitzer. So if you remember nothing else, remember that these people took on a tremendous burden and survived. So surviving was a type of battle. A battle with hunger, privation, a battle with fear, a battle with anxiety. And once again, we're in the middle of a war too. So maybe we can take some solace in the fact that our forefathers, we have their genetic material right here. We have their bands of strength within us. It's been a great pleasure meeting with y'all tonight, and hopefully I've not bored you to tears. Lights, please.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.